Welcome to another of our regular series of podcasts with Imre. I'm Kerry Herford-Jones, and joining me today is a young man by the name of Peter Russell, who, during his gap year for university, where he's studying marine engineering, decided with a couple of friends to just, well, circumnavigate the UK. Now, that sounds okay by itself, but then if you take into account the fact that it was on a very small 22-foot sailing boat, you start to understand some of the challenges they faced. The circumnavigation itself took 2 months of actual pure sailing, covering just under 1,600 miles from Harwich, around the top, and then back down to Harwich again. He often says to people about the challenge that whilst they were not the quickest to sail around the UK, and were certainly not the smallest boat to have done so, they were definitely the most cramped. Peter Russell, thank you very much indeed for joining us on this week's podcast.
Hi, thank you.
Peter, we always like to invite our guests on these podcasts to take a few moments to just describe their experiences to date and what got them involved. So take it away and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I grew up sailing and my parents sailed around the world before I was born, and I've just been in the RYA training programs and building my experience over the last few years.
There's obviously something deep rooted within you in terms of wanting to get out on the water as much as you possibly can. And that really, I presume, is what led to you deciding to take up this challenge.
I think personally, there's never really been anything else much in my life. You know, I do a couple of other sports, but it's mainly all water-based.
What is it you get out of being on the water, Peter?
I'm not entirely sure. It's difficult to explain, but I kind of just feel more myself when I'm on a boat or afloat, and more comfortable and relaxed. And it really helps to sort of cleanse my mind. I know that probably sounds a little bit weird, but it's very peaceful.
Not at all. I think anybody who's had anything to do with the water feels that moment of release when you're actually out there. You obviously just woke up one morning and decided to go and sail around the UK. Is that it? Is that how it works?
Not quite. So basically, the sort of the building point for this trip is over the last few years, I've been building my experience, and ever since I can remember, I've dreamed of sailing around the world. That's like a big pipe dream of mine. So I guess I had a year off from college, and I was going to try and do some Atlantic circuits and stuff. And then I did a trip on a boat that I was borrowing from someone, and it all sort of suddenly clicked, and I realised that actually I didn't want to sail around the Atlantic. I wanted to have my own adventure, and the trip sort of grew from there.
Clearly, mum and dad, hugely influential in your sailing progress.
Yeah, I don't think I would ever really admit that to anyone in conversation, but I suppose they are probably my biggest sailing heroes. You know, I've grown up with awesome pictures of Caribbean islands and all their photo albums and stuff. So I suppose that's been a massive influence, really, yeah.
Look, you know, we're all influenced by things. We're all led down these roads that we go to. But somewhere down the line, you have to make a decision about what it is you want to do. And clearly, what's happened in 2020 with COVID meant that you actually had to reshape your thoughts, reshape your plans.
It did. And I'm very glad that that happened, because it actually gave me an opportunity to find some new angles, new ways of looking at things that I hadn't looked at before. I've always sort of been very focused on what I want to do, but actually being able to work with Imre's meant that, you know, in a moment where I was focusing on enjoying an anchorage or a sunset, I was actually thinking, oh, could we get a pilotage picture here, or could we get a bit of information here? And it just gave a whole new perspective to the way we were sailing and the way we were traveling. It was really interesting.
And that is about giving something back. You know, many of us, particularly of a slightly more advanced years, you know, you do take in as much that the pilot books are there. You take them a little bit for granted. You take their knowledge for granted. You take the pictures. Well, that's great that they're there. But then there's that thought process that goes behind it of who actually comes up with this, who actually goes in. So really and truly, you're not just taking the sponsorship that Imre provided, but you're actually in a position there to then give something back.
Yeah, indeed. And more generally speaking as well, not just Imre, I see sailing as a community, and it's a community that I've taken a lot from over the years, people helping me out, lending me their boats, etc. And I was thrilled. I always take any opportunity I possibly can to give back to that community. And Imre is undoubtedly, with all the charts and books, a massive part of that, and being able to help in any way we could just felt like the right thing to do.
And of course, you're right up there in the cutting edge with technology. You took a drone with you on this trip.
Yeah, we did. So we had a DJI Mavic Mini, I think it was. Excellent drone. Really small and super compact, so great for a small boat. But actually a little bit more rugged than a lot of the really small drones, so we could still fly it when it was a little bit windy. It was great for capturing those extra photos.
And that gives, again, a unique insight into some of our amazing coastline, doesn't it?
Absolutely. So there's one anchorage in the Black Isles in Scotland, which I always use as an example when I'm talking about the drone, because in the pilot book, I think it was a 9 meter contour, but the anchoring instructions for that specific anchorage were that there was clear sand in the 9 meter contour.
Right.
And in less than 9 meters of water, there was really thick kelp and your anchor would foul. So clear sand in 9 meters, less than 9 meters, lots of kelp. And you couldn't really see that as you came into the anchorage. And certainly in the picture that was in the pilot book, it was difficult to see. But as soon as you put the drone up and you got that aerial perspective, you could see really clearly the blue of the sand and then the really dark kelp. And I believe that did make it into the pilot book for Scotland.
Well, look, let's just talk a little bit more about the trip, because, you know, I think hugely inspiring for people to hear. There you were, getting a few friends together and setting off. So this whole trip, you needed some pretty close friends who were prepared to rough it a bit, didn't you?
Yeah, so Simon was a school friend, and I've done most of the sailing that I've done where I've been skippering, yacht deliveries, dinghy cruising, starting with borrowing people's yachts from the sailing club. So he's been sort of there with me from the get-go, and he's certainly been in some situations that I wouldn't like to be in again together. So there was a connection with sort of skipper to first mate kind of thing there, and I knew that I'd need him to come along. And Izzy sort of came in later, but again, very close friend, and we all knew each other very well. So it was, yeah, a very tight-knit team.
Having got your team together, it then needs the boat. And clearly, you managed to find something that requiring a lot of work. But that's often the way we all start out, is making it your own. But Muffin did need a fair bit of work by reading your log, certainly.
Yeah, so we'd been borrowing her for 2 or 3 years, I think, before I actually bought her. So there's a very kind man at our sailing club who saw us dinghy cruising, lent us the boat, and 3 years in, I bought her off him. And the benefit of that is we knew exactly what needed to be done to the boat by the time we got it. And took us about 6 months. We built a new keel and did some fairly heavy reinforcement work on the inside of the boat. Just not many people take a 22-foot boat on a trip as long as we were taking it, and we knew she was going to need a little bit of extra strength to give her the best chance of taking us safely where we wanted to go.
I think we need to know what exactly she is.
Well, she's a Vanderstat Ocean 22, and as far as I am aware, she is the only one in the United Kingdom. Incredibly popular in Holland. They were built to the 8th ton rule, which is the same as the Hunter Sonata. So they're kind of the Dutch equivalent of that, if you want to envisage.
Well, sitting on a Hunter as we are for these podcasts, there's a connection. And the whole thing with that now, clearly, having done the circumnavigation of the UK, is you and Muffin are joined at the hip, and you would recommend that particular brand to everybody.
Yes, indeed. It's cramped and uncomfortable, but I don't think you'll find a better boat for pure sailing performance in that size range, to be honest with you. She blows me away every time I get behind the tiller.
Wow, well, that's confidence for you. So look, expectations for your trip, for your circumnavigation, what were your expectations for that trip?
The expectations, well, it was a difficult one. Just before setting off, I suddenly became really apprehensive. I had, and up until, you know, literally sailing out of Harwich Harbour in the last couple of weeks, I started to have real problems with sort of doubting myself, doubting the boat. Have we done everything right? But as soon as we got into it, I realised that, you know, it was going to be all right. Expectations before that were just for an amazing adventure. We were initially going to try and go up and do the Orkney Islands and Shetland, but we ran out of time because of COVID, sadly. So the expectations sort of changed as the COVID situation developed and lockdown got extended and things. But it was always to just have an adventure, and the plan was quite loose, and we just wanted to go and cruise and see where the wind took us.
Literally and metaphorically.
Indeed, yeah.
Part of the deal with IMRE in terms of the sponsorship, you were clearly well placed then to have as much information at your fingertips as you possibly could have. What sort of things did you have on board, and what sort of things did you access digitally?
So we carry, in my opinion, paper navigation on a small boat, especially a wet small boat like Muffin is quite difficult, because having all those books and all those charts out on a table where you're using them is quite risky, because they can get wet. So I'm sure. Fairly set in the idea of trying to navigate electronically now.
Yep.
And on big ships that's possible, because they have lots of redundancy. And so we had lots of redundancy. We had a chart plotter on the bulkhead, and then we had an iPad and three phones, all of which had chart information, tidal information, weather information. So we had lots of backups of backups of backups to try and keep some form of electronic navigation going. But IMRE very kindly also sent us a full set of paper charts to go all the way around the country,
wow.
Almanacs, pilot books, everything. But we used them mainly for passage planning.
Sure.
And then once we were at sea, unless it was a long passage like the one up the Irish Sea, we did plot a position every 2 hours.
Yeah.
But other than that, they were kind of wrapped up in cotton wool.
You've talked a lot about using the digital elements of the pilot books and the charts and all the different apps that IMRE have available. Let's talk some of the things that you used on your circumnavigation and what worked well for you.
In order to sort of work well with IMRE, we downloaded most of the apps that they had available. So we had the IMRE Navigator app and the IMRE Tides app. The Tides app specifically was probably one of the most used things on the boat. So we used that. It's great because when you come into an anchorage, there's no need for secondary port tidal calculations or anything. It's all basically there, and they've got a lot of the smaller harbours and places, like for example, when we visited Dunbar, there was just instantly, Dunbar Harbour, you could see what time high tide was, what time low tide was, and it tells you at that specific moment how many metres above LAT the tide is.
Yes,
quite. So when you come into an anchorage, you don't need to work it out. It just says, boom, the tide's going to go down another 2 metres, or, it's going to go up another 5 metres. Between high and low tide, which makes that a lot easier. So yeah, that's probably what we used most.
And of course, the beauty with the Tidal app, the IMRE Tidal app, is of course it's so easy to use on any device, isn't it?
Yes. So I don't have it on my laptop, but again, like I was saying about the sort of redundancies, Izzy had it on her phone, Simon had it on his phone, and I had it on my phone as well as on the iPad. And it's such a convenient format, to just pull your phone out of your pocket and have it there. And the same with the Navigator app in terms of using charts, just to pull it out of your pocket and use it.
And the detail, that's the important thing, I think, with the IMRE apps. There's and the IMRE charts, really, really good detail.
Absolutely. So one of the things we did before we left is we downloaded a full set of Navionics charts as well, because in order to give IMRE the best feedback, we discussed this with them before we left. We downloaded sort of the nearest competitor so that we could compare, because, obviously without any product, there's differences. And when we've come back, having used both of them, we can definitely say we do prefer the IMRE one. And I haven't been paid to say that. But the IMRE one is a lot better for, when you're coming into a harbour somewhere like that, like you were saying, just that insane amount of detail, really, really good sort of instant. You can see it there. That buoy is flashing in that sequence, which the Navionics one, sometimes you have to, click on the buoy or
yes.
something like that to get all the information.
Yes.
And whereas with IMRE, it's just there and it pings off the screen.
Now, of course, the whole thing with all of these things is it's great when they work. But as you say, about having redundancy levels in there. And also, of course, having the 4G signal available, 3G, 4G, or to come, of course, 5G signal. But you didn't have any problem at all in terms of the circumnavigation and getting the signal and it plotting and it working well for you.
So you can download the IMRAE charts. And one of the things that IMRAE do, which I really like, is when you buy a pilot book from IMRAE, or I think it now comes with some of the chart packs that you can buy as well.
It does, yeah.
You get a code and you can scrape a little silver foil off to expose a code, and then you can download the digital charts for that area, which is great and really useful, because you don't have to buy, you know, for Navionics, again, you have to buy the whole of the UK and Ireland, and it costs quite a lot of money. Whereas for IMRAE, you might only want to cruise the East Coast. So you buy the East Coast pilot, and then with that, you get the charts for the East Coast. And again, you can download them. So download them on a Wi-Fi signal at home, and then in data range, out of data range, they work perfectly, because it just gets a GPS signal down to your phone, which is, you know, it's not going to be as accurate as the GPS in the chart plotter or that's linked into the VHF, but it's accurate enough to navigate safely by.
And that the point you're making, I think, and it's a very, very well made point, is we're talking here about some pretty close pilotage into some of the harbours or anchorages. And that's the real win here, isn't it?
Yeah. It's the high level zoom, you know, close quarters pilotage. There was one moment specifically that springs to mind for a classic example of this was coming into Newlyn Harbour. And we were beating up to the harbour entrance. There's a isolated danger mark, which is a post that sticks up just off the beach at Newlyn.
Yep.
And we knew we needed to tack and clear the isolated danger mark. And then, you know, we'd be safe to sail in towards the harbour.
Yes.
And as we came in before we tacked, we were looking on the IMRAE Navigator app and saying, oh, are we going to clear it? Are we going to hit it? You know, and obviously, you know, looking with our, you know, just eyeball navigation as well.
Of course.
But we tacked and we could see straight away, you know, even with your eyes, you're kind of looking at it and going, oh, are we going to make it? Are we going to make it? But you could look down at the phone and, you know, it's obviously not something that you want to trust 100%, because, as I said, the phone GPS isn't accurate enough, and that's no fault of IMRAE. That's something in a phone.
Sure.
But you can look straight away and say, yeah, we're clear of that. And as you come in, you can zoom in further and further and further if you want to, just to get an idea of how much you're going to miss it by. And you know, we cleared it with a very comfortable margin. But, you know, that decision about were we going to hit it, weren't we, was made a lot easier with the app and the phone.
Really good example there, Peter. And I always think the incredible thing now, and been sailing for a little while on my part, is that something, you know, how can we put this kindly to Muffin, but an older style boat, you can fit it out with all the electronics and all the gizmos and everything you could possibly need on an old bit of kit, that basically you revolutionise that whole experience safely, competently, and clearly from your point of view, safely around the UK.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's not just the fact that she's a small boat, as you say, it's the fact that she's an old boat, and more specifically with wooden boats, I think this is an issue, is they leak because they're old and the waterproofing technology wasn't as good. And, you know, as I said, the paper charts are a bit of an issue sometimes, and the paper books, because they get wet, you know, and in wooden boats, I know that it's a tale as old as time that the charts get wet and the books get wet, and it's something you're always fighting. Whereas, you know, with this, I just spent a little bit of money on a waterproof phone before we left, and suddenly it, as you say, it's all there at your fingertips, ready to go, as much information as you can download. It's brilliant, completely revolutionary.
What made you choose to go clockwise rather than anti-clockwise?
That's an interesting one. Initially, the plan was actually to go anti-clockwise, so I wanted to sort of blitz our way up the east coast of England, because I didn't feel like there was masses of anchoring opportunity there, and personally, I like to try and avoid marinas wherever possible. So we were pretty much going to try and just blitz it up to Inverness, and then spend a lot of time up in Orkney and Shetland, make our way back down the west coast of Scotland, do the Irish Sea at a much more leisurely pace. But sadly, with the lockdown restrictions we had at the time, Wales and Scotland were taking a little while longer to come out of lockdown than England was. And so phoning mariners going north was how I gauged whether or not we'd be welcome in that area. So I'd phone the local marina and say, would you take a yacht for the night? And there were lots of mariners on the south coast saying, provided the yacht is your primary residence, yes.
Yeah.
And going north, the further north we went, the more no's we were getting. So we figured that by doing the south coast and then the west coast, we were travelling further and therefore giving Wales and Scotland longer to come out of lockdown so that we didn't end up getting to, you know, the Farne Islands and then just having to sit there or sit in Berwick-upon-Tweed and wait for weeks for Scotland to come out. We could keep moving and make the most of the little time we had left.
Yeah, no, sounds eminently sensible. In terms of the planning that we've talked about already, in terms of the balance between printed and digital, and I completely get all of that, how did it all work in terms of the balance for the planning, the actual putting the pilotage into nav, and then how did that go with your crew? What was the balance and how did it all work from your perspective?
So the passage planning was something that we very much all did together. So Simon got his Yachtmaster theory before we left, and Izzy's kind of grown up on boats. So we absolutely, it was a team effort to write passage plans, but we write, my passage planning style is quite loose. I think a Yachtmaster instructor would probably have a heart attack if they ever saw one of my passage plans. But I don't like the prospect of we're going to be here then because we need to be there then.
Yeah.
Because in my experience, you know, the wind is a fickle mistress and you never get exactly where you want to be at exactly the time you want to be there. And especially on a trip like the one we did up the Irish Sea, where we weren't going to arrive in Scotland for sort of 4 or 5 days, I wasn't about to write a passage plan based on the idea that we'd arrive off the Mull of Kintyre at X time.
Sure.
So for the longer trips, the passage plan sort of rolled as we travelled. So we wrote the passage plan to go around the Mull of Kintyre a day before we wanted to get there, because we had a much better idea then of how fast we'd travelled over the last few days and what the weather was going to be doing, and, you know, more of an idea of what time we'd get there than we did 4 days ago. But for shorter trips, like the one from Dartmouth round to Salcombe, it was sort of just look at the tide, see roughly what the water's flowing in which direction when, and just make a rough calculation of, oh, so long as we leave at some point between this time and this time, we'll be all right. And then just went and, you know, looked at tidal entrances like Salcombe or the River Deben in Suffolk's another good example, where you've got to make a tide gate to get across a sandbar or something. You know, if there was something like that in the pilot book, we paid attention to it, and we absolutely used the IMRAE books to their fullest, took every bit of information we could about the harbours out of them, because at the end of the day, that's what they're there for.
So let's have a little bit more of a detailed thought about some of the places you went to, because I think people would be really interested to know, in Peter Russell's visits to all far-flung places of the UK, your top three harbours. Which would they be, if I put you on the spot for that one? But what are your top three, Peter?
Does that have to be a harbour, or can I include anchorages?
You can include anchorages by all means.
Okay, so top three. Well, I would say, probably one of my favourite places is Studland Bay.
Yeah, I go with that.
On the south coast. Yeah. I've been there many times, love it. Second would be the Black Isles in Scotland. It's a tiny little cove between two islands just on the way up to Oban. And it's just completely untouched scenery, rugged landscape. You're miles from anywhere, and it's isolated and genuinely one of the most beautiful places I've ever been on a boat.
Wow.
And then the harbour, the favourite harbour would probably be Dunbar, which was an interesting one. We got some good information for IMRAE there, but the harbour master was just a crowning feature there, really. Genuinely lovely man, really helpful. And I'd recommend that harbour to anybody who's sailing around.
Everybody's going to make a note of that now in their diaries of places you have to visit. Peter Russell's top 10 places to visit in the UK.
Yeah.
Like anything, there's always another side. There's always the ones perhaps you weren't, I'd say unwelcome is a bit strong, but certainly weren't perhaps as well fitted out or well set up for of those of us of a leisure sailing disposition. Perhaps one or two of those that you would think, they perhaps it wasn't as good as we'd have hoped it might be.
Well, we enjoyed every harbour we went into. In terms of sort of negatives, I'd say Solcombe is one of the most beautiful places we went, and I absolutely loved it, but it is chuffing expensive.
and can be pretty rolly in there when you've got the jet skiers going past.
Indeed, yeah, and especially on sort of teenage budgets, it was not very kind on the bank balance. but you know, lovely harbour, very helpful staff, and properly set up for cruising yachts. So,
yeah. I mean, that's one of those classic harbours where the life and soul of it is all so centred around the boating community. Yeah. And of course, you often get there, the actual crews of the harbour taxis are often connected to the boats, part of the RNLI crew as well. So you get a real connection there, don't you?
Absolutely. It's somewhere I wouldn't mind living one day if I ever had the money, because it is just, you know, it's a waterfront community and I really love places like that. So other than the cost, I can't really complain. Another would probably be Newlyn, which is near Penzance. And it was actually a really beautiful harbour, and the kind of harbour I've always dreamed of going into, you know, like big sloping stone walls and a tiny entrance that you have to kind of thread the needle on your way in.
Take your life in your hands, gulp hard, swallow, and then go for the gap.
Indeed. Actually, we started off anchored outside, but it looked like there was some weather coming in. So we went in to try and find the harbour master and get a space in the harbour, which, you know, it's said in the pilot book, to be fair, this is a fishing harbour. They'll only really take yachts in an emergency. But the beautiful thing about Muffin is they can normally fit a small boat in somewhere. Yeah. And the harbour master was quite grumpy and not massively helpful or polite. And I said, is it all right if we just come in, if it gets a bit too rolly in the anchorage? And he was like, no, you've got to come in now or don't come in at all. And so we sort of, we went in, obviously, but he wasn't very polite or understanding. But I would still recommend it as a nice place to go, because the harbour's very well protected, and
it is.
It's an experience going in somewhere like that.
Yeah, I think everybody should visit Newlyn. I think you should visit the pubs in there are interesting places to go as well. But again, the RNLI operate a fantastic boat out of there as well, fantastic crew.
Absolutely.
Thank you for that. That's always interesting, right? People's perspectives on places they've been. So what lessons have you learnt from that circumnavigation? What's, when you came back and you sort of cleared the boat down, got it all into your Renault Clio and drove off into the night, reflecting back on your time afloat, what did you get out of it?
Well, once we got back, I think Simon and Izzy moved off the day after we came home, and I stayed on the boat for another 2 weeks, and I think for me personally, that was reflection time. I didn't feel ready to return back to sort of normal life. Mm. And I think really I'm still working out what I've learned from it. But okay. I know I've learned a hell of a lot about the sea and passage planning and sailing generally, preparing a boat. But I've also learned a lot about myself and what is an effective way to run a crew. And I'm very glad that I learned those lessons with two amazing friends who have always been very forgiving, because I will grant absolutely fair play to them. I made a lot of mistakes in terms of my crew management, and I think at times they probably wanted to get off the boat, but they were great at telling me when I was misbehaving, and we worked through it together, and I think I've come out of it as a better skipper. Everyone's learned their own lessons from it, yeah.
We had those original expectations we talked about earlier. What were the biggest differences between what you'd hoped to achieve and what you actually achieved? Or did it all marry up?
Well, the boat leaked a lot more than I expected it to. so we had.
I'm laughing because I'm not on it, you know.
yes, indeed. Yeah, it wasn't too bad. But, you know, when you pulled a packet of soggy crackers out of the bilge, having expected a nice sundowner, and your beer cans have rusted through, it's not quite so pleasant. But, you know, other than that, it was how I expected it, but I was expecting to be able to cruise a lot more, and when we got somewhere, stop for a few days, go into the museums, experience the local places, because the UK is a very vibrant culture, and actually, sure, as British sailors, we tend to go off to France or Spain or sail around the world, and we don't experience the beauty of our own country. So I was initially really looking forward to seeing those places, and obviously because of COVID, the museums were all shut and everything. With the time restrictions, we were kind of really racing to get round as quickly as we could, so I feel like we did slightly miss out on that. But other than that, the sailing and the adventure side of it was all kind of exactly how I was hoping and expecting it to be.
Looking at the conclusion of the circumnavigation, it took you how long and how many miles did you actually cover?
So it was 3 months and 1 day that we were actually living aboard the boat, and I think around 2 months that we were sailing, and then we covered just under 1,600 miles of sailing from Harwich round the top and then back into Harwich.
That's an amazing accomplishment, Peter. You must be well pleased to have done that in a small boat with your friends like that. I mean, I think that is absolutely brilliant for your first big adventure.
Yeah, I absolutely am. I often say to people, we're not the quickest people to sail around the UK. We're certainly not the smallest boat to have done it, but we are definitely the most cramped. Three of us on a 22-foot boat and sometimes four. It was an amazing achievement, and that's something that's only really just starting to sink in, quite how special and amazing it was, because for 3 months it was just life and it felt normal, and it's taken a little while for it to properly sink in.
Well, I'm sure you'll dine out on it for years to come. You've obviously got some thanks you need to give, Peter, to people that helped you and supported you on your circumnavigation.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the first and biggest thanks I would give would be to Simon and Izzy for coming with me and putting up with me and for being there. But after that, it would be Imre and the Royal Cruising Club. So I'm a cadet member of the RCC, and they've always supported me sort of with advice, but also financially. They have an amazing fund pot called the Noel Marshall Fund. Anybody can apply, you don't have to be a member, and it's aimed at giving young people opportunities that they wouldn't otherwise have. So to do the Irish Sea trip, my insurance company told me that I needed full offshore safety equipment, dam buoys, life rafts, flare boxes, proper certified life jackets, etc. And there was no way on the budget that I was operating on and on my bartender's wage that I could afford all that equipment.
Sure.
And still save up enough money to be able to travel for the summer. And the RCC were fantastic, and they paid for all our safety equipment for the trip so that we could get that insurance and so that we could get around the country. And I can genuinely say that without them, we wouldn't have been able to do it, because we wouldn't have been able to secure insurance for the boat. So yeah, that's probably the sort of one of the biggest thanks. And again, to Imre, because there's no way that, as a sort of, well, I wasn't a student because I was on a gap year, but on a student budget, I'll put it that way, that we could have ever afforded all those charts and pilot books that we needed. And as we said earlier, to sort of give back to the sailing community by helping them out felt like no charge at all for the information that they gave us.
Brilliant. What we have to look at then, Peter, is, and the big $90 million question has to be, what next?
What next? Well, Muffin is still in the picture, so we're doing some more small boat adventures over the next few years. I'm thinking of possibly trying to take her across to Ireland or down to the Spanish Rias at some point in summer holidays from university.
Great.
But post-uni, the long-term plan is to build a boat and sail around the world on it.
You just throw that into the pot there. Just throw it in, yeah, you know, we'll do that. And clearly, but this doesn't happen by itself. It was obviously built on the layers of experience you'd had, including, I think, you had a very early result as a skipper of a delivery boat, didn't you?
Yeah, so that was an interesting one. Simon organised it just from an ad on Facebook. Guy said, I'm looking for someone to deliver my boat. And Simon contacted him and said, I can't do it, but I know a man who can. Are you interested? And they said, yes. And then he phoned me up and said, I need you to deliver this yacht for me. And I said, well, what is it? And he said, it's a Hans 38. And I said, Simon, I'm not a fully qualified delivery skipper. You know, wow. And in the end, I went to this guy and I said, look, I'm not a fully qualified delivery skipper. I don't have insurance. If we do this, I want you to come with me. But yeah. I can say that a delivery skipper is going to charge you a lot of money for this, and we'll do it completely free so long as you pay for our food and for our transport home. And he said, okay, let's do it. And I'm so thankful to that kind man for giving me the opportunity to skipper a boat myself overnight down to Southampton from Ipswich, because I'm very self-critical, and actually that trip gave me the confidence within myself to understand that I do have the skills and I do have the knowledge to get on with it and go and have amazing adventures and skipper my own boat. So yeah, that was a key moment, I think, in having the confidence to buy the boat and do the trip.
Let's just bring this all together then. So first of all, thank you very much indeed, Peter, for joining us for today's podcast.
Thank
it's
you.
Been an absolute pleasure talking to you. And I hope you'll come back and join us again. We'd like to follow your career, wherever it may take you.
Absolutely. I'd be more than happy to do this anytime. Thank you.
Peter, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Cheers. Thank you.
Join me, Kerry Herford-Jones, again soon as I meet up with more of the people who research and contribute to the many books, guides and charts that IMRAE produce. This podcast series is produced to hopefully provide some inspiration and help you gain the confidence to explore more of the waterways of the world.